Well, welcome to the second of the seven talks, and to anyone who hasn't been here at Woodbrook before, a very warm welcome, and hope you'll feel at home and enjoy your time here, and that we'll see you again. So this is the second of the seven, and it's the history of Quakerism we're going to look at this evening. These first two talks are very much focused on the early years and some of the subsequent history, and the talks from next week will very much focus on the present day, and we'll be able to reflect a little more on the kind of Quakerism we find here today and some of the challenges and opportunities that it's facing. So, the Quakers, once they decided to set up a movement, were immensely successful at it. Within the relative liberty of the 1650s, Quakers embarked on an extensive program of mission work. 60 to 70 pairs of ministers and elders, after Luke 10:1, travelled England and Wales and later Ireland to help people turn to this new covenant with God now freely available. In 1658, Quakers set off to convert the Pope, and Mary Fisher met with the Sultan in Constantinople. Early on, too, Quakers were exploring America, both for mission work and in terms of emigration. Numbers rose until about 1680, when up to 1% of the population were Quaker. In some places, such as the important port of Bristol, it's claimed that 10% of the population there were Quaker at one point. Now, Quakers appear to have been very able preachers and were prolific in their tract writing. It's not always easy to extract the theology from these writings, but the power and energy of the writing is very evident. The appeal is obvious. Unlike the Calvinists who talked of predestination, the Quakers are claiming the possibility of universal salvation. Everybody can be part of the elect. Here, too, is a group without any fixed leadership or spiritual hierarchy, the ministry open equally to men and women, and women numbered about 45% of the early Quaker movement. And here was a group with a radical spiritual vision with radical political implications, yet retaining a clear and strong moral line. It was an attractive mix of ideas, experience, and possibility. Now, the movement also attracted a lot of hostility. The doctrine of perfection, this idea that once transformed Quakers could resist temptation, infuriated those who placed an emphasis on the sinful nature of humanity. And the whole of Quakerism appeared to many to be set up on a series of highly arrogant, if not blasphemous, claims. In particular, the claims that the saints were as Christ, the children of God, put both George Fox and James Naylor into jail, and nearly cost Naylor his life. Enacting a sign of Christ's second coming by riding a horse into Glastonbury, Wells, and then finally Bristol in 1656, surrounded by other friends, saying, "Holy, holy," was not unusual behaviour for these early Quakers. But after the Bristol incident, Naylor was tried for claiming he was Christ. He wasn't hung, but he did suffer horrendous treatment. He was sentenced to public flogging, the branding of his forehead with B for blasphemer, and the boring of his tongue. That very nearly killed him, and then after that, he was imprisoned. Now, Naylor was seen by many to be equal to Fox in the leadership of the movement, and for such an important friend to be sentenced in this way was a fragile moment for early Quakers. There was conflict as well amongst some of the Quakers in London over this, and it was a time where Quakers really needed to regroup. At the same time, it's difficult for any group to sustain grand claims over time. What happened to the doctrine of perfection when a Quaker was found drunk in the street? And if all had equal access to God's guidance, how could Quakers disagree? And who was to know who was right when they did? And if the second coming was unfolding and Christ was coming to everybody, well, how long was that process going to take? I mean, how long could you keep saying Christ is coming, Christ is coming? Now, what we find is that the Doctrine of Perfection was modified as early as 1653, when Quakers began to claim that different people had different measures of the inward light. What was important was that each friend lived up to their measure. After the Naylor incident in 1656, part of the response there was to say that anyone with a leading from God or a concern should test it corporately, that somehow there was greater reliability in numbers. And this ideal of kind of collective reliability has been retained to this day. References to the immediacy of the Second Coming tend to fall away after even the events of 1666, with all those sixes in the date, and plague and fire and the destruction of the British Navy by the Dutch. After even those events fail to herald any global transformation, we find that they don't talk about the Second Coming so much. The 1660s are actually different and difficult times for the Quaker movement. The restoration of the monarchy brought with it imprisonment and explicit legislation such as the Quaker Act of 1662, and the death of some of the leading figures. Naylor died in 1660, Edward Burrough in 1662. Overall, the Quaker response was increasing formalisation. There's a whole new pattern of local meetings set up in a hierarchy up to the yearly meeting, the national body. The energies of the leadership shifted from mission to internal administration. And in 1671, we get a publications committee. And anything to be published in the name of Quakers has to go gain their approval. And there's a group called Meeting for Sufferings, established to petition government about the sufferings of imprisoned friends. And we also see the introduction of separate men's and women's business meetings. Fox arguing that it was necessary for women to have their own meetings so their voice could be heard. Although we need to point out that the areas of influence were highly gendered, women tending to look after poor relief and marriage arrangements. So that while there was an ideal of spiritual equality, political equality was not always following it. And in fact, it's the 20th century before we get a fully united men's and women's business structure. Now, as I said last week, in the 1650s, we don't get a systematic theology. Quakers are full of the experience and full of the mission imperative that that experience brings. And it's 1676 when Robert Barclay, a second-generation convert, writes the first and one of the last systematic Quaker theologies. Now, Barclay maintains the universality of the direct encounter with God, the need to test leadings corporally, and the doctrine of perfection, although he does sort of claim it's you can be fully perfect but always capable of further growth. So fully perfect but not quite fully perfect. He doesn't mention the Second Coming, and in fact at the end of his work, where you would expect to find mention of the Second Coming, there's actually long lists of advice about how to live in the world, how to live in the meantime. Now, this kind of advice was becoming increasingly prescriptive. Margaret Fell called it a silly, poor gospel. But what we see is witness moving from being a consequence to a symbol of faithful waiting, from a consequence to a rule. And there was a real challenge here for the second and third generation of friends, brought up as Quakers by their parents, but having not yet experienced transformation. So how do you wait faithfully? Barclay further heightens the stakes when he writes that while everyone would have a day of visitation from God, if anyone should miss it, then they would outlive their day of possibility of salvation. Now that would produce a certain amount of anxiety. And certainly one of the key words here is diligence. Young Quakers were brought up to wait diligently, certainly not to let their own emotions interfere with their spiritual life. So music or reading fiction particularly, which isn't even true, and the theatre were considered inappropriate pursuits. Quakers could only marry other Quakers, and the breaking of any of these rules could lead to disownment. In other words, you would lose your formal membership. You wouldn't be allowed to be call yourself a Quaker, although you could still attend a meeting. You wouldn't have access, for example, to Quaker poor relief. Now, these rules, in a sense, became an internal Quaker version of the Christian meantime. They didn't change the way they worshipped, and we'll talk about this next week, but maintained this inward spirituality, the direct encounter, but adopted, paradoxically, lots of outward symbols of piety, such as plain dress, plain speech, thee and thou to everyone, and plain living, in order to separate themselves from a corrupt and corrupting world. So from being co-agents with God, what we find in this in the 18th century is a much more hedged-in Quakerism, fearful both of God and of the world around them. Barclay's Apology had a quote from the letter to Titus on its cover about being purified unto God as a peculiar people, and these Quakers aspired to such peculiarity. Now, the other paradox is that outside what's been called a familied monasticism, a guarded home life and meeting life, these Quakers are actually very involved in commerce and industry, very involved in the world. The Darbys of Coalbrookdale were Quaker, and will be familiar with Fry's and later Cadbury's and Roundtree's as Quaker chocolate companies. Barclays Bank and Lloyd's Bank were originally Quaker. Denied access as nonconformists to professions or parliament, Quaker energies were directed to commerce and industry. In Darlington, the football club is still nicknamed the Quakers, as the town's fortunes were so dominated by them. So, diligent waiting rather than zealous mission work, but with its own rich spirituality. The enthusiastic and the eschatological disappeared, but still we have this claim to know God directly. All was to be guided, and the primary concern was the individual friend was following the true guide. In the journal of the New Jersey friend John Woolman, we find the unfolding spiritual journey of someone always open to being led by God, seeking clarity for his concerns on war tax resistance, Native American rights, the plight of the poor, seeking other American friends to join him in his stance against slaveholding. He sells the family business and in order to serve God, and he wears only undyed clothing, as the dyes were a product of slave labour. When he felt he'd been unfaithful, he was laid low in bed, often for days, until he felt forgiven and restored. Everything was to be led by God. Now, other examples of this can be found in deliberations over marriage. Catherine Phillips waited 23 years before being clear that she'd found the right partner. Joseph Conran felt, quote, a draft of love more than natural, i.e. supernatural and therefore to be trusted, not human, when he first saw Louisa Strongman, and he felt sure she was to be his wife. 2 years later, he told her, and 6 years after that, they were married. So there's always the what and the when. Both are very important. Norwich friend Elizabeth Gurney, later Fry, wore scarlet laces in purple boots under her Quaker grey, but was then persuaded to a more diligent life by travelling minister William Savory. Moving to London with her husband, she became involved with women prisoners awaiting transportation at Newgate Jail, and she went on to help thousands prepare for their journeys, providing them with quilting kits so they'd have produce to sell when they reached Australia. Her work was part of the ongoing Quaker concern for penal reform. Now, the 19th century saw the end of Quakerism as a single community, and with it the end of the claim that Quakerism represented the true church. Now, these two facts are related and link to the influence of the evangelical revival on Quakerism, firstly in the USA, then in Britain. This brought about internal theological dispute, but also encouraged the evangelical Quakers, at least, to see themselves not as the true church, but as part of the true church. That is part of wider Christianity. So what we have in the 1820s is a tension between those influenced by the evangelical revival, who want to place a greater emphasis on scriptural authority, and quietists, some of whom have taken whom have taken the sort of inwardness of Quaker spirituality to such an extreme degree that anything outward, even scripture, is then considered suspect. Now, both of these positions are innovative, but the fact that they coincide means they really are pulling in two opposite directions. These groups become known as the Orthodox and the Hicksites, respectively, and the division that comes between them as the Great Separation. Now, it reaches a point in 1827 where actually there's such antagonism that both groups wish to separate in just an attempt to purify the yearly meeting. And after Philadelphia yearly meeting in 1827, there are then two yearly meetings, two Philadelphia yearly meetings, one Orthodox, one Hicksite. And other American yearly meetings divide in the years that follow. Now, each side struggles to maintain control of the meeting house. There's the property. And, of course, the minute book. And both of these are symbols of sort of the inheritance, the true inheritance. And there's some really quite alarming stories for a pacifist group of people being pushed out of windows and locked out of meeting houses, fighting over the minute book. Each side, because then both have set up the yearly meeting, each side then disowns the other en masse. The Orthodox disown the Hicksites for their wayward theology, and the Hicksites disown the Orthodox for their poor discipline. Where one group lost the meeting house, they built another, sometimes just across the street. Now, in the 1840s and 50s, the Orthodox, we just leave Hicksites on one side for a moment, then underwent further schism over this continually vexed question of the role of the inward light. Now, British Quaker Joseph John Gurney, Elizabeth Fry's brother, highly influential in Britain, embarked in 1837 on a 3-year speaking tour of the States to find his views opposed by John Wilbur of Rhode Island. Now, the division here is that Wilbur believed that you needed to balance the authority of the inward light with the authority of Scripture. Gurney would claim that the inward light was there to help friends read Scripture correctly. In that sense, Wilbur found Gurney too worldly and his view of the inward light too innovative. Now, New England yearly meeting, Wilbur's yearly meeting, actually preferred Gurney's position, and they ended up disowning Wilbur and most of his local meeting. And that ultimately would lead to two New England yearly meetings in 1844. Now, one of the traditions between yearly meetings is that after having met, a yearly meeting would send an epistle, a letter of greeting to the other yearly meetings. And, of course, once you've got two Philadelphia yearly meetings or two New England yearly meetings, A, you've got to decide who you send your epistle to, and B, when two of them arrive on your desk, you have to decide which one to accept. Now, Philadelphia got round the problem and the concern about splitting again by deciding it just wasn't going to engage in any correspondence at all. But essentially, other yearly meetings found themselves needing to make a decision and getting involved in further schism. In 1854, after a further split in Ohio, we can find then three Ohio yearly meetings, a Hicksite one, a Gurneyite, and a Wilburite. Now, to the outsider, the non-Quaker, all of these groups would have looked pretty indistinguishable. All worshipped in silence in meeting houses, all maintained a distinct way of conducting their church business, that is, without votes, all dressed and spoke in the peculiar Quaker fashion, all maintained their witness against war and against slaveholding. Thousands of slaves were helped escape through the Underground Railroad run by Quakers, where homes would operate as safe stations for the locomotive. But more visible, perhaps, to the non-Quaker would have been, than the theological divisions, would have been the divisions there were in each of the three groups about A, how far you would work with non-Quakers on social justice issues, and B, whether you were prepared to break the law in this kind of work. Now, in 1842, Gurneyite Indiana Yearly Meeting divided because some friends were so committed to law-breaking against in their campaign against slavery. Now, for the Gurneyites, who found their unity in terms of doctrine, it may have been inevitable that further schism would take place. If you remember, they've already separated from the Hicksites, and now the Wilburites have separated, and in the 1860s, we then find two tendencies, not a further schism, but two tendencies developing within Gurneyite yearly meetings. And these are renewal or modernist and revival stroke holiness. Now, renewal Quakerism wanted to renew Quakerism, simply. It wanted to make it modern, of its time, but distinct, and work with other Christians in social justice activities. They believed humanity would usher in the Second Coming, a position that's called post-millennial. Now, revival Quakerism was also meantime in its theology, but pre-millennial. The world was so depraved that Christ would need to come to initiate the rule of the saints. And these revival Quakers are fairly wary of a rather corrupt world and its ways. And whilst they work with other Christians within the holiness movement, they are generally more guarded about alliances. Now, early friends had, or I should say, and there's a lovely quote about this guidance, that football is unworthy of the sanctified, and union cards carry the mark of the beast, one holiness friend said. Now, last week when we looked at convincement, the transforming experience of early friends, we saw that it was a single experience, even though it could be divided into six components. For revival friends, what they did was separate a first and second blessing experience, a conversion and sanctification. So David Updegraff, a leading holiness friend, had a major conversion experience in 1860, but it's 9 years later that he experiences sanctification when, quote, every vile affection was nailed to the cross. And what happens for revival friends is that they bring in thousands of people through the revival meetings. These revival meetings are very exciting. They're involving preaching, lots of emotional expression, music, mourners' calls, mourners' benches, altar calls. And Indiana Gurneyite yearly meeting, for example, grew by 50% in a 9-year period. Got thousands of converts. They're then coming into a Sunday morning meeting for worship, often which, very different from a revival meeting in tone and energy. And there's a need, obviously, to induct these people into Quakerism, but also to nurture their faith. And what happens is that pastoral committees are set up to facilitate a teaching ministry. But this quickly leads to the release or payment of single-person pastors. And we get the first Quaker pastor at work in 1875, and by 1900, most American Gurneyite yearly meetings had pastors. At this point, of course, some friends then schism off that the introduction of pastors is one step too far. And they join with Wilburite friends and form the conservative tradition. (Clears throat) what we get very quickly, although we'll look at worship next week, is that you move from having pastors to having the worship led by pastors. Now, if we can just turn back to the Hicksites for a moment, this was a group, of course, that was found its unity in the discipline, in the process of being a Quaker, the experience of worship, the inward encounter. And as such, they didn't suffer doctrinal division, as the Orthodox and Gurneyites did. But they did, there was some breakaway from groups called progressives, who sought a more radical political agenda, particularly over slaveholding and women's rights. Others pursued that agenda within the Hicksite fold, and Lucretia Mott is a very good example, working tirelessly for the abolition of slavery, joining those outside of Quakerism to do so, founding the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society, which was interracial and interdenominational, and being one of the organizers of the Seneca Falls Convention for Women's Rights. Now, in Britain, the situation is slightly different in that there's no schism, but there is certainly a lot of theological change through the 19th century. The evangelicals gradually become ascendant over the Quietists, and Quakerism in Britain also becomes part of the true church. One of the characteristics of that evangelical influence is that the peculiarities are abolished. And I should say that in the American Union meetings, these also disappear around the same time. So Quakers lose the rule about only marrying another Quaker, and they lose the rules, basically, the instruction to plain dress and plain speech. Now, in Britain, the membership had reached an all-time low of about 15,000. And so this was of grave concern to the evangelicals, and they felt, you know, they could see other Christians who didn't have such a lot of restriction, and yet who seemed none the worse morally for it. So after 1850, British Quakers can have their gravestone, and the rule about marrying out was abolished in 1860. And in 1861, plain dress and speech become optional. The paradox is that in time, this very freedom, this opening up of the doors to the world, would bring about the demise of evangelical Quakerism. Younger friends, attracted by biblical scholarship, higher criticism, start to lay out a new agenda for Quakerism. And in a very rapid turnaround, we move from an evangelical Quakerism in Britain to a liberal or modernist approach. John Wilhelm Rowntree, whose picture you'll see along the corridor there, was the leading architect to liberal Quakerism in Britain. And by about 1905, when Rowntree tragically died at the age of 37, the underpinnings of liberal Quakerism were secure. The other thing we need to mention is mission work. Now, it starts with home mission in the 1840s, popular devotional meetings, Sunday evening meetings, sitting alongside literacy work of the adult school movement. But after 1860, both British and American friends look to overseas mission work. And in the 1860s, friends go to both India and China. In 1902, three friends land in Mombasa and set up a mission at the other end of Kenya. Now, by 1914, there were 50 converts. But today, over a third of world Quakerism, over 130,000 Quakers, can be found in Kenya. Mission to South America in the 1920s has also led to significant numbers of friends there, particularly in Bolivia and Peru. What we find is, after 1870, British Quakers can enjoy full citizenship without compromise. They can become MPs, they can join any of the professions, they can go to the university of their choice. And for about 40 years, there's an increasingly cosy relationship between Quakers and the state. It's almost as if the more the state tolerates Quakers, the more Quakers tolerate the state. The stop in that process comes in 1915 when conscription is introduced, and friends again find themselves protesting and law-breaking. And since that date, there's been a much more guarded relationship between Quakers and the state. There's the Friends Ambulance Unit, offers alternative service, and in America, the American Friends Service Committee is set up, funded by a number of different yearly meetings. During and after both World Wars, actually thousands are helped, particularly in feeding and reconstruction programs. And between the wars, Friends work with refugees in the Spanish Civil War, but also organize work and food for starving miners in the Appalachian Mountains, and help with projects for the miners of Bryn Mawr and Maesi Huff in Wales. This sort of the work, particularly the reconstruction work and food supply work after the World Wars, is acknowledged in 1947 when the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to British and American Friends. Now, the joint American peace and social justice work ultimately paves the way for Friends across the different branches, across the Hicksites and Wilburites and Gurneyites, to begin to talk to each other again. And what we find in the 40s and 50s are a number of yearly meetings that then begin to reunite in New England, Philadelphia, in Canada, and later in Baltimore. We can summarize the 20th century as being about mission, but also the growth of modernism, in the sense of a clarity of the differences between an evangelical Quaker agenda and a liberal Quaker one. At the same time, the commonalities remain. The sense of direct encounter with God, reliance on God's guidance in life and in church business, the spiritual equality of all, and the testimony to peace and social justice. And next week, we'll look at the nature of Quaker worship in more depth and explore how these commonalities are played out in different ways. Thank you very much.